Two of our favorite veterinarians are here to answer your pet care questions. Here comes spring at long last, and maybe for you that means spending more time outdoors hiking or tossing the frisbee with your pooch. If so, remember to protect that dog against ticks, which can carry Lyme disease and anaplasmosis, among other things. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll get answers from our two experts about the latest generation in preventative flea and tick control. We'll also find out about new screening tools and treatments for other pet medical issues. We'll discuss proper disposal of pet medications, the pros and cons of pet insurance, and why it's so important to keep marijuana away from your dog or cat. What are your questions for our veterinary experts? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Our pets, they can bring great joy and comfort, but also worry and stress. Today, we're going to speak with two veterinarians about the latest in vet care, and we will get the answers to your pet questions. With me in our studio, Dr. Amy Rukshanese. She's a veterinarian with the Topsom Veterinary Wellness Center. And Dr. Ezra Steinberg is also with us today. He is Specialty Medical Director at the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. As always, we want to hear from you. What is the best pet care advice you've ever received? What question about your dog or cat have you been trying to get an answer to? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Ezra and Amy, welcome. And I understand that today is National Pet Day. So everyone ought to be doing what? Giving their dog a treat today or an extra long walk?
Absolutely.
Celebrating.
Absolutely. So I just want to start by asking each of you, and I'll start with you, Ezra. What are you seeing right now in your practice? Are you seeing a spike in anything, in any trends?
So as the weather warms up, it's still April, but I feel like it should be a little warm.
It's supposed to be 60 on Friday.
I'll believe it when I see it. We do see a different variety of issues as the weather warms up. Animals are outside more. So at Maine Veterinary Medical Center, we're a specialty and emergency practice, so we see probably a different caseload seasonally. This time of year when dogs are outside more, we definitely see more trauma. Unfortunately, motor vehicle accidents, and something that I was really looking forward to coming in today, my public service announcement about keeping your dogs away from porcupines. So we see porcupines quilling incidents year-round at our hospital, but this time of year, it's unbelievable. We'll see several in an evening, and they can be really, really bad. And I'm sure many of the listeners out there have had encounters, but they...
You said several in the evening. Do the porcupines start moving around more in the evening? Is this people getting home from work and taking their dog on a walk in the woods right as the porcupines are coming down from the tree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think people are just outside with their dogs, and it's dark out, so your dog sort of starts to explore a little bit. And then you're like, oh, why is my dog heading towards those bushes? And they come back sometimes not even recognizable as a dog because their face looks like a porcupine.
And what's involved in dequilling a dog who's gotten into trouble?
Yeah, great question. So if we catch them very quickly, the dog comes in and it quite often requires sedation because there can be hundreds of quills. So if there's two or three quills in their nose, we can usually pull them out without sedation, just give them some pain medications. Oftentimes we need to fully sedate them, sometimes anesthetize them and pull them out. Quills are really difficult to get out because they're sort of barbed, so they like to go in and then they don't like to come out, and they migrate very, very quickly. So if you don't catch them quickly, you don't want to say, all right, let's go to bed tonight and then we'll wake up in the morning and go to the vet. You really want to get it taken care of.
When you say they migrate quickly, you mean they get deeper and deeper?
So they go deeper and then they're very difficult to even feel. And then, some of our worst stories are seeing dogs sometimes weeks later and they're in the heart. I've pulled them out of the heart, out of the big blood vessels in the chest, out of the lung. They're really nasty. And, we have a CT and an MRI at our hospital, and there's really no good imaging technique for porcupine quills. There's just really no good way to find out where they are.
So and porcupines are slow, right? So these are dogs who are curious or checking out what's going on. So just if you've got your dog off the leash, pay attention,
just
right?
Pay attention, especially if you live in an area like, yeah, maybe you don't let your dog off leash when it's dark out and you can't see what's going on.
Okay. Amy, I want to bring you into the conversation. What are you seeing right now in your practice? More of anything?
So, yeah, as Ezra said, I'm definitely not looking forward to porcupine season at all. And I'm sure there's going to be some callers that have questions about that. But as a general practitioner, the spring screams the beginning of seasonal allergies. So all the itchy dogs and cats, you come in and we have to try and figure out, is this truly seasonal? Are these dogs itchy because of something environmental, or is it just coincidence? There's environmental allergies, there's more fleas around, all that stuff.
Oh, so that's interesting. Humans, our eyes, our eyes get red and itch, and we sneeze a lot. But with dogs, it's more itchy skin?
Itchy skin, ear infections, runny eyes can happen. Usually the eye situation doesn't tend to be as much of a medical concern when I see them, but they do certainly come in for that being the owner's concern.
Are dogs allergic to the same kind of pollens humans can be allergic to?
Yeah, definitely.
And are there Zyrtec and Claritin for dogs?
Yes. Yep. There's antihistamines that some animals are definitely you can utilize those, and then there are some animals that antihistamines won't touch, and so you have to try and figure out, is it something that we can use over the counter, or are we going to our more magical cabinet of other drugs that we can use to make them more comfortable? So it's a guessing game every year.
Isn't that interesting? So. Let's talk about, I know that it's now year round that one needs to protect your dog against ticks, but this time more than ever, there are, Amy, new choices for protecting dogs from Lyme disease and anaplasmosis and all that terrible stuff that comes with ticks.
Yeah, so the tick burden is just getting bigger and bigger. I grew up in southern Maine and never had to deal with ticks, and it just seems like they're just moving up the state and becoming more and more of a problem. And everybody's grossed out about them. Everybody wants to do something about it. And the grossness factor is one part, but the tick-borne diseases is the other. Their dogs are symptomatic with Lyme or the other tick-borne diseases, like you said, anaplasmosis. There's other ones, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, babesia. And every time we turn around, there's a new tick-borne disease that I know when I hear about one, I'm like, oh, I hope this isn't going to happen in dogs, or horses are also affected with tick-borne diseases. And there's just so much out there. But there are really good tick preventatives. And I hear every day when people are introduced to these newer, faster killing products out there, they're just like, oh, thank goodness for that product. And oh, I wish I could take this myself, because they're just so bad.
Because there's a vaccination now, correct?
There is. Yep. There's been Lyme vaccines for a couple decades, but we just keep learning new things about Lyme and how it's transmitted and how we have to protect from it. I don't know the ins and outs of why the human vaccine isn't available. There was one originally, but I do know that there's a lot of dog owners that have had experience with Lyme vaccines, and every story is different. But what I do counsel my owners on is that they keep progressing and how effective and how appropriate they are, in that they're not causing as much vaccine-induced pain or reaction sites or anything, reaction issues with the vaccine. And the newer vaccines are just much more protective. So it's nice to stay on top of that and let people know what's out there.
Ezra, are you seeing more animals that have been exposed to marijuana now that it's legal in Maine?
We do. We see a ton. And I guess in Maine, we've been seeing that for a while. It is something that they talk about in Colorado. I think maybe the difference is now when animals are coming in, people are more willing to admit what is wrong with their dog. So it is a very, very typical presentation. These dogs are sedated. They're leaking urine, and I mean, it's just an obvious toxicity, but before when it was illegal, sometimes you'd have to say to them, people, like, we really need to know if there's any chance your dog got into marijuana. Oftentimes they would say no, and we would be 99% sure that they did. Now they're much more willing. But, yeah, it's the edibles that are the biggest problem.
Oh.
And because, you know, you're putting marijuana into chocolate or cookies,
so
or something
that
the dogs love.
So then you have a double whammy. You've got some fudge brownie with the chocolate and the marijuana.
If they eat enough, correct.
Yeah.
But yeah, we just see it all the time now. And
how toxic
really good,
is it to animals?
So yeah, it's I would say with the amount that they consume, it's rarely life threatening. But they definitely need to be hospitalized. And we have really great treatment. We have this something called Intralipid, which is an injection that sort of scavenges the psychoactive component, the THC, out of the bloodstream. And that's made a very, very big difference. But we have dogs that are They're in rough shape when they come in, but it has a very good prognosis as long as the appropriate care is taken.
So if your dog or cat gets into marijuana,
yeah,
do you watch them or do you take them to the vet right away?
So you can call, ASPCA has poison control, which I know that we've broadcasted on this show prior, but I would call your veterinarian if they're open, or if not, the emergency hospital such as ours. And just to get some advice. So oftentimes we can induce emesis at home. You can make your dog vomit by giving them peroxide, which most people should have in their house. And if it doesn't come up or you're unsure how much they got, it's really best to be taken in for observation. And again, the good thing is that it's treatable. I would not necessarily watch and wait.
So a new report out of Oregon State University is advising veterinarians to better inform people about disposing of pet medications, which, Amy, are okay to throw in the trash, which are okay to let sit in the cupboard for a while, and which do you really need to treat like so many human medications and find a place to dispose of them?
I think you can look at it from two perspectives. One, we do prescribe controlled medications, so there is that risk of that getting into the wrong hands. But there's also the fact that all those drugs going into the environment is never a good thing, and I think proper disposal is easier and easier. I know that the municipalities will have drop-off locations, and I don't think that they would tell you that we take these drugs and these ones we don't. I think they would be willing to take whatever drugs, and then you don't have to worry about them getting into the environment or into the wrong hands of people, or just sitting there and being expired and not appropriate to keep in your cabinet.
All right. Well, I'm going to start with the questions. I'm going to start with Nora on Facebook. She says, is there any pill or medication to add to food for feral cats to block pregnancy? When a cat does not want to be trapped, it cannot be trapped.
Birth control for wild cats. I don't know them personally, but I know that that they have things like that for.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing that you're going to be able to buy over the counter or get prescribed by a veterinarian. The best thing to do is call your local animal control if you know of a population of cats, and many places have, or shelters have, like a trap neuter release program where they can come and assist you somewhat. But really, spaying that cat would be the best way to control the situation.
Yeah, and Carl Little from the Community Foundation also posted on Facebook that the Maine Community Foundation's Belvedere Animal Welfare Fund supports organizations and programs that address population control for cats and dogs. The deadline for applications is June 15th. So if you're involved in an organization that looks at population control for dogs and cats, go ahead and look at Carl's post on our Facebook page. We're going to go to Patrick, who's calling from Cornish. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me on. My dog, Cricket, and my cat, Esme, were both patients of Dr. Amy's. And
yep,
great,
they were.
Great thing with Cricket, because Cricket was an older lab, and she pulled Cricket's teeth, which made Cricket a much, much happier dog. I wish you'd go and talk a little bit about the proper dental care for both cats and dogs, and how you can start out with a puppy or a kitten and get them used to good dental care by the owner and what to expect from the veterinarian.
Sure, Patrick. Good question. This is the one thing I really regret with my dog, is that I didn't get her used to having her teeth brushed as a puppy, because she sure doesn't like it now.
No kidding. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for calling. So yeah, there's so many different, people get overwhelmed with dental care, I think, pretty quickly. And so I try and include that in just a conversation about, this is what I see in your pet's mouth, and these are things that I hope you're doing. One is definitely toothbrushing. We take care of our own teeth with toothbrushing. And we brush our teeth front to back. We're putting our toothbrush into our mouth from the front going to the back. And I've personally noticed that animals tolerate it a lot better if you go back to front. And so I always counsel my clients on putting them in a position, the pet, in a position where you're behind them. And if you have a finger brush or you have a toothbrush and you're actually, you know, lifting up their lip and actually not poking them in the face, they're not getting that toothbrush coming at them, I feel like they tolerate it better. And when I demonstrate that in my exam room, people are always like, oh, I could try that. Let me try that. And so it kind of gives them a new opportunity to try something that seems very overwhelming and depending on the pet, may not be a very big deal. But that's only one thing that you can do for dental care. You can also encourage mechanical breakdown of the tartar with chewing. And so I encourage animals to have something that they can really, like, put their, especially in dogs, put their paws around and really kind of gnaw with their back teeth. It doesn't have to be like a fatty, high-calorie treat. It could be an Ilabone, which is plastic, so calorie-free for the overweight friends of ours. So that mechanical breakdown is something. The toothbrushing, there's treats out there that both may mechanically break down tartar or they have some sort of additive in them that will bind to the bacteria that causes plaque, so they swallow it instead of it being kind of covering their teeth. There's all kinds of different stuff out there. There's dental-specific foods that do some of those things, so there's a lot of different options, and you can brush your cat's teeth the same technique that I was describing, so it's doable.
Patrick, thanks for the call. We'll go to an email from Todd. I have a cat that's been diagnosed with a physial fracture. What do I do? Ezra, what's a physial fracture?
Yeah, so a physial fracture, Jen, is, and Todd, I guess if you wanted to call in to get more specifics, but the physis is the growth plate. So it's just the technical term for the growth plate. So I assume this is a younger cat that sustained some sort of trauma, and we have growth plates at the end of all of our bones. So, you know, depending on the age of the animal, there could be a significant long-term issue if it's not repaired. And what we typically do for these is we repair them with surgery. So it's rare, unlike a kid, it's rare that we can cast these or splint them and get them to heal okay. Just due to the location, it's really tricky. Getting that fixed with internal fixation, so some pins or plates or screws, however we're going to fix it, depending on the type of fracture, is going to be the best in terms of the long-term prognosis. We had one, we actually just got a fluoroscopy unit at our hospital, so it's called a C-arm, which allows to do real-time x-ray, which is really, really great for physial fractures because you don't have to open them up, so you can repair it minimally invasively just with tiny incisions through the skin. And the best thing about a physial fracture is that they heal so quickly, so it's a young animal. So they're usually healed in 4 weeks as opposed to an older animal, which their fractures will take 6 to 8 weeks.
Just like us. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can tweet at Maine Calling, email to talk@mainepublic.org, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Norris, helping businesses and schools stay safe through engineered security, life safety, and emergency communication systems. NorrisInc.com. Frenchie's Maine Woods Bug Dope, made with essential oils and formulated to protect you from mosquitoes and black flies. Available at frenchiesnatural.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
This week, Congress is asking CEO Mark Zuckerberg to define what Facebook is.
When people ask us if we're a media company or a publisher, my understanding of what the heart of what they're really getting at is, do we feel a responsibility for the content on our platform? The answer to that, I think, is clearly yes.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly, the evolution of Facebook, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the escalating trade dispute between the U.S. and China and the possible consequences with Robert Kuttner, author of the new book, Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? And we'll discuss the connection he sees between global capitalism and the rise of the far right in the U.S. and abroad. Join us.
Fresh Airs tonight at 7 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, veterinary care. Joining me, Amy Ruxenese. She's a vet with the Topsom Veterinary Wellness Center. And Ezra Steinberg is also a vet. He's with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Here we are on National Pet Day. We'll go to Eileen, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Eileen. Go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi. Hello? Go ahead.
Hey.
Yeah.
Okay. My question is about dental care. I have a 14-year-old cat who has had dental work done in the past, but it's not recommended. They don't recommend it at this point. And he will not let me brush his teeth, has never let me brush his teeth. And I know that I have heard that there are some gels that I can actually apply to his mouth that will help break the tartar and the plaque down, not to ever bring him back to bright, shiny teeth, but certainly help get rid of it. And I know that they are enzymatic. There's many, many, many of them out there. And if you could give me a brand name, that would be great. If not, could you tell me what kind of ingredients I should be looking for?
Yeah, I can try. Some of that stuff is all in the vault, and I have to actually look it up myself. But you're right. There's enzymatic dental products out there that are breaking down the bacteria that then the next step creates plaque, and then plaque turns into tartar. So what you're trying to do is prevent that bacteria from kind of hanging out, swimming in the mouth, and causing the plaque. The brand that I would send you towards is the CET line of dental products. They have oral rinses and toothpastes and a number of other things. And CET is what you would look for. It's made by a company called Virbac. So that's a direction I would head. I can't remember the active ingredients of what you're trying to get at as far as the binding products.
Yeah, and I guess one other thing that I might add, like if there's a lot of tartar buildup on there, all the enzymatic cleaner in the world is going to be very difficult to remove all of that. So I don't know. I mean, I've tried that stuff on my own dog just for fun. It really didn't do very much. I'm not the most compliant owner. I have not brushed my dog's teeth daily for the duration of their life. But the other thing just to note is that some cats have other diseases with their teeth that are just not going to respond to this. So some cats have just this generalized inflammation in their mouth, or underneath the surface, the roots of the teeth are sort of resorbing. So it's not just what you see on the surface. And I know you said your kitty was 14 years young, and you know, I don't know if you've had a discussion with your vet about not proceeding with any type of surgical dentistry, but if the cat doesn't have any other comorbidities, so any other thing going wrong with them, we'll still do anesthesia on a 14-year-old animal, and we don't do dental care at our hospital. But, you know, as long as everything else checks out okay, we anesthetize 14-year-old animals all the time. So maybe just another conversation to have with your vet if you're truly worried about the oral hygiene.
I agree. I think that the biggest thing that we can say to keep it simple is age is not a disease. And there's lots of things that we can do to kind of help you decide to either go with an anesthetic procedure or not. Sometimes you do come up with things when you do screening blood work to say, well, maybe that isn't a good idea. And we don't know your 14-year-old cat's medical history, but it's something to consider because age isn't the reason that I would decide not to do a dental.
Agreed.
All right, Eileen, thanks for your question and good luck. We'll go to Ryan calling from Dresden. Hi, Ryan. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to be one advocate on the line for the purchasing of pet insurance. I have a six-year-old yellow lab who, over the course of her life, has torn both of her ACLs, and my wife and I invested in pet insurance when she was, you know, when we first got her, when she was a puppy, and the company we used eventually covered 80% of both surgeries, plus 80% of physical therapy afterwards, plus now she's on a bunch of joint supplements and whatnot to combat arthritis, and it's been, you know, a real significant help for the both of us to make those decisions to proceed with, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 surgeries much, much easier when we know that 80% of that would have been covered. So,
Ryan, you are brilliant, Ryan. You are speaking to two veterinarians and animal owners that both have yellow labs. We both have insurance for our animals. Only one of us sitting here has had a yellow lab with two ACL tears that were surgically fixed.
By the other one.
It is not me. But yeah, Dr. Rekshanis has a yellow lab that we did both knees on.
So all Labrador Retriever owners out there are the highest priority for looking at
everybody.
Pet insurance.
Everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, pet insurance is amazing.
Your dog's owner, it's a lot more expensive. It's older. It's a lot more expensive. My dog's 11, and I did a little search.
So there comes a time when it doesn't make sense to have insurance, but it's not like they're uninsurable when they get older. It doesn't work like that just quite yet. Maybe in 10 years when the whole industry is tainted, that might happen. But I have insurance for my own dog, and it came in huge this year. And I work for myself. Like, I'm my own veterinarian, and you'd think that we wouldn't need insurance. Amy has insurance. I have insurance. So yes, Ryan, that was the smartest thing you can do. And insurance is great when you need it, and when you don't have it, it's some people think it's a waste of money. It's just some people insure a lot of things, and some people don't really believe in insurance. But if you have a pet and you don't have a huge fund that you can dip into, of course, it makes perfect sense. These companies these days are amazing. There's some, I'm not going to mention names. You can do your own research, but I'm sure it's the one that, I think it's the one that you're talking about, Ryan, now it's not even a reimbursement policy, depending on if your veterinarian has any sort of connection with them. So they'll pay up front. So you don't even have to put the money down and then you have to wait for your check to come in the mail. They pay up front now. And it's the best it's ever been.
Because we
I'm
have
sure
a
it helps with some help with hard decisions too.
Yeah.
It does on this side of things. As a veterinarian that wants to do the best thing for the pet that's in front of us, we have the ability to really take the opportunity to do the best thing for the pet, because money isn't as much of an as a deterrent. They can say, "Do what you need to do," instead of, "How am I going to pay for this?" And so we get answers faster, which means a lot of times the animals are able to get on to be recovery instead of waiting and trying one thing and then trying another thing, because we're trying to be cognizant of the costs and everything. If pet insurance is part of it, it's almost like you hear in the back of your head, game on. Like, we can do what we need to for these pets.
And cost is real. Like, with my own dog, if I didn't have insurance, I just put him through. He has cancer, and I had to do a ton of diagnostics and a ton of treatments. And honestly, like, if I didn't have insurance, it would have changed how I handled this whole thing. So it's a game changer.
Ryan, thanks for your call. We have an email from Linda. I wanted to ask about the danger of off-the-shelf flea products. Last season, not one but two of my friends used off-the-shelf flea products. I can't recall if they were powders or shampoos. Both their dogs had very bad reactions, requiring them to see their vets. One of them said it was a well-known brand name like Hartz, which she trusted. Any advice on this so that similar situations can be prevented? Does this sound familiar to you all?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so well-known brand isn't necessarily always the best thing. I would say trust your veterinarian on this one. Like, go to your veterinarian and ask for help. Don't try to fix a problem by just going to Walmart and grabbing something off the shelf right there. They can be very, very scary, and we see them at the emergency hospital all the time. These are they're they're harmful products. They're pesticides. They're some are organophosphates. It's not a good word, and they can make animals really, really sick. So trust.
How come they're on the market?
That's what everybody asks us. So there's a difference between EPA regulated drugs and FDA regulated drugs. EPA drugs are not having to go through all of the jump through the hoops in order to get approved, the same way that FDA drugs are. So a lot of those over-the-counter topicals can be EPA-regulated, which means the companies can throw them out into the world and not have as much safety data or, you know, any of that stuff, where FDA really makes the companies prove that it's safe. And Linda mentioned, no, somebody said hearts was, you know, that's a scary word in the veterinary world.
Wow, that's really good to know. Well, I'm going to follow this up with an email from Laura. She says, can your guest discuss the dangers of the flea and tick medications now on the market? These are pesticides. If one goes to your vet and gets a flea and tick medication, it's not going to be a pesticide?
So if you break down the word pesticide, then yes, it's going to be a pesticide. But people's perception of what a pesticide is needs to be kind of revamped a little bit, because there can be a product, and all the newer generations of these flea and tick products are they may be neurotoxins to a invertebrate animal, but not a mammal. And if we're protecting mammals with a product that hurts the invertebrate fleas and ticks, then that's it's not something that's unsafely going into the dog's body that's going to harm them. It's only affecting the insects that are on them.
We'll go to Larry, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have to disagree. I'm absolutely sure that the old age is a disease. I'm over 70.
Are you
suffering? Larry, you sound great.
You know, when you pick up a dog because someone says, I don't want this dog anymore, and so you take it in, frequently their dew claws are there. If the breeder hasn't removed the dew claws, is it worthwhile removing them or just to hell with it?
Larry, if they are not causing a problem, leave them alone. There are some animals that will get them caught on things and they can get injured, but leave them alone. I actually, amazingly enough, yesterday had a surgery where I used the skin from the dew claw to cover a big defect when I removed a tumor down on the foot. So that wouldn't have been possible had the dog had its dew claws removed. So, yeah, absolutely. Leave them alone. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Thanks, Larry, for your question. We'll go to Susan calling from Portsmouth. Hi, Susan. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 10-month-old yellow lab, my third lab. My last one also tore both her ACLs, by the way. She recently got Giardia, which, you know, I know isn't that uncommon. However, you know, the medication that she took, I read it, and I swear to God it said carcinogenic. Now, I don't know if that's even possible, but it sounded horrible. So I just wanted to ask you about that. I did give it to her. It was only a 7-day dosage. The other thing is I just got a Seresto, or not sure if I'm pronouncing it right.
Seresto, yeah.
You know, I don't really like it, but I love the fact that it's 8 months. Can you talk about, like, is that unsafe? Like when you pat her, you touch her neck? Like, just maybe talk a little bit about that. And thanks for taking my call.
Thanks, Susan. So the medication that you took for 7 days, probably Panacure, maybe.
Yeah,
Amy's,
I think so.
Amy's nodding yes. It may say crisis. So this is a very, very popular deworming medication, and it's generally very safe. We use it all the time, and it's a great drug. Many drugs are probably going to say that they're carcinogenic. I would have minimal to zero concerns about that. Amy, you agree?
I would agree. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of things that are on labels that get people scared, side effects of drugs. Sometimes if you read every single one of those side effects, you don't want to give them the drug, or you don't want to take it yourself. But when that stuff is on the label, sometimes it's just during clinical studies, there's just so much that goes into label making that I think personally, when we get to use these drugs over and over again, and we're using them so much that you'll just have to take our word for it that we wouldn't be giving something that was carcinogenic in a way that we thought we were going to affect our patients.
Yeah, and then I'm waiting for Amy to respond about the Seresto collar because that's what I use on my dog. So I want to see if she approves.
Why don't you tell us why you decided to use that collar?
I did some work down at University of Pennsylvania. That was where I did most of my training. And we're very big on tick prevention. And they were fans of that collar. But I do like a flea collar. I have two children at home. One's 6 months, one's 3 years old. The dogs have the – I have two yellow labs also. And the dogs have the collars on all the time. We try not to touch them. I actually try to tuck them underneath their other collar. I have been meaning to do this for a while, but some people have actually fashioned some sort of brace or put like zip ties to keep it on the inside of their other collar just to keep it covered. But these companies, as opposed to Hearts, do tons of research and development, and they would not allow – If there were some harmful effects, they would just not allow these to come to market. So, you know, I put my faith in these companies that are producing these, and if they have responsible R&D, I trust them.
All right. Well, we're going to take another quick break before we do so. A word about tomorrow's program. We're going to be talking about migraines. So if you have comments or questions, you can send those in ahead of time to talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as do Northeast Imports in South Portland, specializing in the sale and service of pre-owned Subarus, northeastimportsllc.com. Green Lion Gallery in downtown Bath, committed to making original art available to all. Shows, classes, and events at greenlionart.com. And New England Cancer Specialists, committed to leading the way to better outcomes for 50 years. More at newenglandcancerspecialists.org. An invasive insect that could kill all of Maine's ash trees and tear up the roots of tribal culture is right at our state's door. Maine is working hard to keep the emerald ash borer at bay, but entomologists say it's only a matter of time before the battle is lost. Maine Public has a special in-depth online report where you can learn more about what's at stake for Maine, including the state's four Wabanaki tribes. Visit mainepublic.org and click on the homepage link, The Scourge at Maine's Door, or search for Emerald Ash. Stay with us at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today, Dooley and Pelosi, Bridging Trump's Divide. It's a political conversation with a focus on energy between a Tea Party organizer and a Democratic superdelegate 1 year into President Trump's administration. That's coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, answers to your pet care questions. Joining me in our studio, Dr. Ezra Steinberg. He's Specialty Medical Director with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. And Dr. Amy Ruskinies is with the Topsom Veterinary Wellness Center. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Going to a tweet here from John. An oft overlooked hazard to your pets are chip bags. It's so easy for your pet to get one stuck on their face and suffocate. Just like you snip six-pack rings, if you have garbage hunting pets, snip the bottom of bags before tossing. All right. You guys ever seen this?
I've never seen it. I mean, I would imagine that it could happen. The only thing I can relate to is my sister had a skunk in the backyard that got its head stuck in a yogurt container, like a narrow. So honestly, we might have to cut everything open before we throw it away because all of those things can happen.
And yeah, especially with labs.
Well, my lab, when I empty the dog food, it's a big, you know, 50-pound bag of dog food, and I leave it on the floor. He goes and sticks his head and just walks around it, and it can't be airtight, so he... But it's quite entertaining to watch him walk around the room with the bag.
Rocket scientist.
Yeah,
he got there.
He's really smart.
We got Tim calling from Portland. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I've got a 13-year-old Springer Spaniel who in October 2016 was diagnosed with degenerative myelopathy, which for people who may not know is ALS for dogs. And in October 2016, they said he probably wouldn't last till Christmas of that year. And he's actually gone, you know, he's survived two more birthdays. But he is mostly blind, and he is mostly deaf, and he does decline, and then he stabilizes and declines and stabilizes. And my hard question for you is, how do you know when it's time to start thinking about end-of-life issues for a dog like that? He still does eat, and he wags his tail when he goes outside, although he tends to just stand in the yard. But how do we know when it's time to start thinking about end of life?
Tim, boy, big Tim, question.
Yeah, Tim, that's probably the hardest question we get. And I'm sorry to hear about him. And DM, for people that don't know, this is a really, really tough disease. And we see it, we have a neurology team, and we see it a fair amount. And it's really difficult because it's not like the other aggressive types of cancer that one minute they're fine and then a couple weeks later you know it's time. DM can go on for a long time. It's usually much more rapidly progressing than that. And it is tough. And you said he's standing in the yard. So I'm assuming that he's not so severely affected, because for people that don't know, these dogs can wind up becoming paralyzed and they have a really hard time getting around. Is he somewhat functional?
Have to carry him. Okay. Yeah, we do have to carry him upstairs and downstairs and things like that. He can walk around. He walks around with a very strange gait. Front feet go twice as fast as his back feet.
And, sure.
He can fall down occasionally. But.
Sure. And it's also, you know, as you know, it's somewhat of a difficult diagnosis to get to. You really have to do an MRI to rule out any other issues. But I'll tell you, Tim, one of the best pieces of advice that I've had for the age declining animal is that you keep two jars on the counter. And you keep a stack of pennies or coins on the counter next to them, and you have one good day jar, one bad day jar. And you start to say at the end of the day, you say, was today a good day for him? And you put it in the good day. And after a while, you start to see a little bit more objectively, because our memories can sort of fool us, and you don't remember if he had a good week or a bad week. And you see over time, you kind of have a consensus at the end of the day how he's doing now. Is he still eating or not? That's tough. I think my dogs will probably eat 5 minutes after they take their last breath. So I don't know, but it's really tough. And if he's developing any ulcers or pressure sores or anything like that, I think that's time. I mean, I don't want to let my dogs get to the point where I've waited a day too long. And we've gotten, this is just the way I feel, that humane euthanasia is like one of the best things that we can do as veterinarians, because we don't have to make them suffer. So it's different for every person, and you know your dog the best, but I think you need to have some sort of objective way by keeping either a diary or this example that I gave to help you look at it a little bit.
Well, Tim, good luck to you. We have an email from Scott. I tried to call but had poor quality. My rescue dog, who has many fears, has had a number of teeth removed because they were in bad shape. Recently, we took him back as there was some bad breath and we feared more issues. We were told that he needed over $1,200 in care. And I'm on Social Security, so that's just impossible. Is there any other choice, or do we need to have him put down before his infections become really bad?
Hi, Scott. So congratulations for rescuing a dog, first of all. It's awesome. And bad breath, bad teeth is a really wide topic. So I can't speak specifically to your dog's situation. But when it comes down to it, we get to know a lot more because the advancements that we have in how we practice. And I can tell you that the difference between when I was practicing without dental x-ray and now with dental x-ray, the amount of disease, like Ezra was saying, that can be under the surface in a dog or cat's mouth is unbelievable. And you don't know until you get in there and you really assess the situation, where they're under anesthesia, we're looking at all these teeth and really deciding whether or not there's enough disease to, one, make the quality of life of the dog a good situation, or that there's something that you can do about it. And tooth extractions is, again, under anesthesia, after you've evaluated all the dental x-rays, it's an uncomfortable situation, so they have to be on pain medication. There's a lot to it, and unfortunately for that reason, it is expensive. But I don't even know how many times I've been told after an animal recovers from those things, how much better the animal feels over and over again. Patrick that called with his story about Cricket, just the fact that when we take a bad tooth or many bad teeth, I mean, sometimes these animals don't even have any teeth left when we're done. They're still happier because there's no disease in their mouth. There's no pain, and they kind of move on with their life instead of worrying about the smoldering or underlying stuff that just makes them feel crappy. And I'm sorry that the money is kind of coming in between those two things, because it's us wanting to make the best decision for the pet, but not being able to do it without really getting all the information before we start, and then going through that really pretty significant process of getting the bad teeth out.
Mm-hmm. And aren't there some programs to help folks with some vet bills?
So I don't know if where you rescued the dog from, but sometimes you can reach to the rescue organization. I mean, a lot of people are doing sort of crowdfunding, and there definitely are many sort of organizations that can help out.
We'll go to Lawton, who's calling from Penobscot. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hey, I'm also calling about kind of end-of-life care. I'm a semi-retired human health care provider and now old fart farmer, and my old fart dog is in heart failure and had a mitral valve, left-sided mitral valve, small dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the saving grace for me is the whole family's in the neighborhood of farmers. We've all got children and cousins of these dogs, and so we've watched the progression of them, and most of them have lived, you know, 10 to 12 years. But I'm just wondering if you guys can talk about, you know, the process of actually putting a dog down, because it is one of the beautiful things about veterinary care, besides the fact that you folks deal with different species of animals, and in human medicine, we're sometimes awfully specific, and so I'm always amazed at what you do, such a broad range that you guys care for.
It's interesting every day. Do you want to?
Thanks for calling, Lon. I'm sorry you're going through all this, but euthanasia, I think, is again, as I said before, it's really one of the best things that we can do. Is the last gift that you can give your animal. And every veterinarian is different. So, you know, this is where you, some people mix well with their veterinarian in terms of their outlook on this. And a couple things. So sometimes we can give some sedation beforehand, depending on how the animal is feeling. But sometimes oral medications that you guys can give at home, so they're already sleepy in the hospital, or sometimes some injectable medications. Most veterinarians allow you to either be with the pet. There are house call veterinarians that can actually come to your house and do that. And the process, and again, this is different. Something that we do is we give an injection to make them very sleepy, and then the next injection stops their heart. And it's a very controlled, very peaceful situation. And it's kind of your call. Like, it's up to you. However you want it to go down, you should have a meeting with your veterinarian beforehand and come up with a plan. And we usually can stick to the plan very well. It's a controlled thing, as long as your pup hasn't progressed too rapidly into failure where they're in a crisis. So, again, I guess my best advice is to reach out to your vet, have a consultation with them beforehand, so you have a plan that you can bring to motion when the time comes.
Well, Lawton, I'm sorry to hear that. Let's see. We're going to move on to Westbrook and Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So my boyfriend and I adopted a little Chihuahua, long-haired mix, we think maybe Pomeranian. She's 12 years old, no teeth, got a wonky leg. We adopted her from Animal Refuge League like a year ago. And essentially, I'm just calling. We're looking for tips on how to teach an old dog how to be more house-trained. She will pretty regularly use the pee pad that we have, but she still poops on the floor. We're just wondering if there is any hope, essentially, of having a poop-free life.
If you can teach an old dog new tricks.
You can teach an old dog new tricks, but sometimes learned behavior is really hard to break. Always keep in mind that your dog having a wonky leg, you know, like there's other factors. It might not be that that your dog is obstinate and doesn't want to do what they're told. They might not understand the cues that you're giving. House training for every single animal is different. Some animals are easier to train. Obviously, younger animals are just ready to learn new things easier. But the biggest thing is whether or not you're giving the dog the right message. Always keep that in mind. Are you giving them opportunity? Are you non-verbally telling them what you expect of them? All those things go into every aspect of training, and house training is part of it. A 12-year-old dog, though, not using the bathroom correctly could have other factors as well. Like, you know, does it have some kidney issues where it has to go to the bathroom more often or anything like that? So, or urinary tract infections happen more in older dogs. It could be multifactorial. I think looking at it from the perspective that, yes, you can teach them things. Are you giving the right message? Are they healthy? Is there anything that you don't know about that's going on? We often see animals for a visit, and we have to determine during that visit or part of the visit if it's medical or behavioral or both when you have a situation like that. So definitely reach out to your vet to find out whether or not there's a medical component, and then know that, yes, it is a little bit harder for older animals. I don't have specific things that you should do with that dog, but keep those things in mind.
Thanks for saving that dog, Sarah.
Oh, she's wonderful.
Sarah, thanks for your call. We just have a few seconds left. John, can you please ask your question quickly?
Yeah, sure. So for the past few years, I've been getting deeper into the aquarium hobby. And I just want to speak really quickly about some of the misconceptions around keeping pet fish, particularly betta fish. I mean, growing up, I always had betta fish in small bowls, but learning more about keeping fish, betta should really be in bigger aquariums that are properly filtered and heated and stuff.
Okay, that's good information, John. Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I'm going to guess that, Amy, you agree with him.
Yeah, I do. That's great to know your pets, for
well,
sure.
Thank you both for being here. Amy Rushkanese with the Topsim Veterinary Wellness Center, Ezra Steinberg with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center, both veterinarians. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Owen Manahan answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives, at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, what we are learning about migraines, their causes, and possible treatments. For those of you with culinary skills, the second annual Maine Public Create It Maine Recipe Contest is underway. Participating is easy, and the winner receives $250. There are also 4 runner-up prizes. So the deadline for entries is April 13th. Visit themainepublic.org for details. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.